really need to think that an undergraduate who we're paying is necessarily going to be less accurate than a volunteer who's doing this just because they're really interested in the project. So this guy was a great great undergraduate. Ben was not. I'm not saying that he was inaccurate, but I think we don't necessarily need to think that just because somebody's not getting paid, they're not going to be accurate. So I'd like to end, if anybody's interested in talking about starting a citizen science project, I would be really happy to help you. John Losey is also becoming an expert on this. He'd probably talk to you as well. Here's contact information. And there's also a great website that just got put up that's run by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology that they're calling Citizen Science Central that is has kind of a lot of hints for developing a citizen science project. So I'd like to end just thanking all the volunteers that have contributed to the data in our project and many of my students who have worked on this project. And our funding has come from the National Science Foundation, Monarchs in the Classroom, and the Xerxes Society. So thanks, and I don't know if I have time for questions. Or okay. Yes. So her question is, have we ever kind of experimentally compared the value of data from the volunteers and undergrads? No, we haven't, but we have actually followed volunteers. So when we had a lot of funding for this project, we did some hands-on training. And we have looked, we've followed kind of your typical volunteers and looked at plants after they looked at plants. And they really are very careful and very accurate. It's interesting to watch them, but I never have done that study. But some of my undergrads aren't all that accurate. So.
Mm-hmm. Have you considered the relative toxicity of individual plants when it comes to egg densities? In my experience, milkweed feeders tend to clump on individual plants that may have a different level of toxicity than others. So I'm thinking, you know, depending on your sample size, you know, maybe this year they're not in your volunteer's backyard, they're in the neighbor's yard that's not getting sampled.
Yeah, and we don't, this is not a perfectly set up, if I were designing an experimental study to answer those questions, oh, I should repeat the question. Do we think about the differences in the quality and the toxicity of milkweed when we're analyzing these data? No, and this is one problem with citizen science data that is almost never experimental. So if we really want to look at the effects of things like toxicity of the plants, density of the plants, age of the plants, we would need to do an experimental study. But we do have people, or a lot of our volunteers, collect data where they compare different characteristics of plants that are occupied by monarchs and are not occupied by monarchs. So we have several years of data where we look at, they're obviously not measuring cardenolide content, or maybe not obviously, but they aren't measuring cardenolide content, but they are looking at things like the condition and the height of the plants, the density of the plants, the presence of other invertebrates on the plants. So we can pull in those data, and we have been able to tease out some things that make a plant more likely to have a monarch on it than less likely.
For a few minutes, let's step back and look at insect conservation and the ESA in a different way. Let's switch lenses, perhaps to a wide-angle lens with a very soft focus. Should our approach to insect conservation be guided strictly by science? What about art and philosophy, even religion? These are cultural connections, and they do make a difference in how the general public views insects. Who should be the primary target of our conservation messages? What are effective ways of communicating this message so the public understands the need?
First, going to talk about the life cycle of the soybean aphid, then we'll move to the life cycle of soybean cyst nematode objectives, and we'll move through the experimental study after that. Soybean aphid overwinters on Rhamnus cathartica, which is a common buckthorn. It hatches in late April to May in the Midwest, and then it goes through 2 to 3 generations on buckthorn before moving to the soybean plants. Once on the soybean plants, it can go through 18 generations per year. and then it will develop wings and move back to buckthorn, common buckthorn, in the fall, where it will mate and then lay eggs again. Soybean aphid is originally from Asia. It moved to the United States in the summer of 2000. It was first discovered in southern Wisconsin. Since then, it has moved throughout most of the Midwestern states where soybean is grown. Moving to the soybean cyst nematode, it has three major life or stages in it. It starts out in this egg, moves to a juvenile, and then ends up, of course, as an adult. Here's just a picture of the adult with an egg. Here's a picture of the J2 juveniles. This is the only stage of the soybean cyst nematode which can infest the soybean roots. And then the cyst is a term that is used for the body, the dead body of the female, which contains upwards of about 200 eggs. The soybean cyst nematode was first found in North Carolina in 1954, moved to Illinois in 1957, and since then has moved throughout most of the Midwest. And the reason for studying both the interaction of both these pests is, as you can see, where this pest infects soybean is very similar to the soybean aphid. So the objectives of this study were to evaluate the impact of resistant and susceptible soybean varieties on the development and reproduction of both these pests in the presence of each other, and to determine how the interaction affects yield on susceptible and resistant soybean varieties. Here's the four different soybean varieties that were used in this study. We have combinations from susceptible aphid, susceptible soybean cyst nematode, that's SD0176R, all the way through every combination down to resistant to soybean aphid and resistant to soybean cyst nematode, which is LD051629. These tags underneath of these will be here under each of the varieties, so you guys can kind of see. The aphid gene is the RAG1. That's how it derives its resistant. And the soybean cyst nematode resistant is from PI88788. And then the four pest treatments that we have in the study were the control, so neither of the pests, only aphid, only soybean cyst nematode, and then both of these pests present together. This trial was arranged in a split block, complete randomized block design. The seed would be the whole plot, and then the pest treatment would be the subplot. Soybeans were planted on May 25th. That's pretty representative for Illinois. Plots were then infested last year with 7,000 soybean cyst nematode eggs per 100 cc of soil. That is an extreme amount. That's kind of what we were looking for. This is actually on the Vet Med farm on the U of I campus. So there was no soybeans grown here, so we didn't have an indigenous population of soybean cyst nematode, so we had to add them. About 2,000 soybean cyst nematode eggs per 100 cc of soil can cause 20 to 50% yield loss. So 7,000 should do the trick. Plots were then caged on June 1st, right after soybeans basically emerged. And then plants were staged every 2 weeks along with weeded and everything like that. We infested 10 aphids per cage during full bloom, which is the R2 stage. 10 aphids were placed on 10 different plants on the most open, youngest open trifoliate. They were placed on just on top of the leaves there. Then we counted aphids twice per week until plants reached the R7 stage. Plants were harvested by hand on October 11th, and soybean cyst nematode samples were taken on October 30th. Moving on to the actual data of this experiment, all the graphs will be set up the same. You'll have the soybean aphid numbers per three plants here on the y-axis, with the sampling dates for the x-axis. The important thing about this graph is you can see that the two resistant varieties for soybean aphid remain, the soybean aphid densities remain very low, topping out at below 50 per plant, 50 per three plant. And then the soybean aphid susceptible varieties, which would be the green line and the orange line, started to increase about the 13th of August. That'd be like in the R3 F3 to R4 stage, and then they basically just took off. Here's just a later season. As you can see, the numbers here on the y-axis have increased all the way up to 10,000 aphids per 3 plants. So densities, aphid densities reach very high. One cage had 52,000 aphids per 3 plants. So we had very good aphid levels this year. While the resistant varieties, again, you can see they basically just hugged that axis all the way across. So that was very nice to see as well. Here's our treatment effect for 2007. Soybean aphids reproduced faster by themselves on 16519, which is soybean aphid susceptible, soybean cyst nematode resistant seed. This did not happen last year. We think this could possibly be a treatment effect or a hybrid effect. So we're not exactly sure why this happened, but again, it was only replicated 5 times. So if you have 4 cages of one treatment, you know, go one way, this can easily throw it off. The yield was very nice this year. The neither pest treatment had the highest yield with 427 grams per 15 plants, with the both pest treatments being the lowest at 320 grams per 15 plants. So here it was interesting to notice that the soybean aphid pest treatments by themselves and the soybean pest treatment with the soybean cyst nematode statistically lowered yield. And then the seeds, 16529 is the resistant to soybean aphid and resistant to soybean cyst nematode that had the highest overall yield, which was expected, with almost 430 grams for 15 plants. And then the SD0176R, which is susceptible to both of the pests, came in with the lowest overall yield at 283.35 grams per 15 plants. There was no difference in the neither pest treatment throughout all the seeds, which we were looking for, so all the seeds had the same theoretical yield with a control pest treatment, and all the seeds had the same as well. So looking at some of the conclusions then, SD0176R, which again is a soybean aphid susceptible, soybean cyst nematode susceptible, and 16519, which is a soybean aphid susceptible, soybean cyst nematode resistant seed, had equally high aphid numbers in 2007, topping out somewhere around 8,000 aphids per 3 plants on average towards the end of the season. Soybean resistant seed never exceeded 50 aphids per 3 plants during the growing season. And the presence of soybean cyst nematode reduced aphid densities only on 16519, which is soybean aphid susceptible, soybean cyst nematode resistant, only in 2007. The presence of soybean aphid reduced yield in 2007. We saw that earlier in the graph with both of the treatments with soybean aphid being reduced. The control treatment had the overall highest yield in the study, and SD0176R, which is soybean aphid susceptible, soybean cyst nematode susceptible as well, had significantly lower yields than all the other varieties. Conversely, 16529, which is resistant to both of these pests, had the overall highest yield compared with the other varieties. With that, I'd like to thank my advisors. All the help to count all these aphids and wash all the nematodes out, it's a lot of work. It's very enjoyable. The Iowa Soybean Board for funding this project, and Iowa State for allowing me to help with this study. With that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
How closely related are all
the varieties? Again, I couldn't.
How closely related are these varieties? Are they back crossings, or what is their origin?
Two of these lines are identical. The SD0176R. And the LD05 are the same lines, just with the aphid resistance built in. That's an early mid-group 2 soybean, which is pretty normal for Illinois. And then the LD05 1619 and the LD05 16529 are also the same. They're same variety, just with the aphid, the RAG1 gene introduced to one, not the other.
Okay.
Matt? No, we did not. We haven't. We're still waiting to wash out the nematodes. We don't know the densities there yet, but we did not see a decrease in yield due to the soybean cyst nematode.
For insect conservation and supports activities along those lines. In the scientific literature, restoration projects, and in the development of conservation lists, comparatively more attention has been given to butterflies than to other insect taxa. This is understandable. Butterflies are beautiful, and also they're non-threatening. They're also, their imagery is found in many cultures, symbolizing things like divine inspiration, reincarnation, the transience of life, liberation and sensuality. Butterflies are a prominent figural form in fine art, advertising, fashion, and jewelry. The plight of other insect taxonomic groups might draw attention because they resemble charismatic species, or because they have long been associated with human virtues, such as industry and humility. But what about all those dull gray and brown moths? What about insects and other invertebrates, many of them microscopic, that are critical to the function of specialized ecosystems, such as the one represented here by Sarracenia purpurea? Does much of the public even know that they exist, or that their future is uncertain because their habitat is being destroyed? This illustration by Joel Floyd is a visualization of the scope of insect conservation needs in the United States. The collage spans the U.S. and highlights various habitats where insects are at risk. On the left, is the El Segundo blue butterfly, and in the foreground is Melanoplis spiritus. Below the ground line are threatened habitats such as the endangered burying beetle, and on the left side, cave crickets. In the center, you see echinacea with native bees, native pollinators, and then on the right, you'll see bogs, and on the far right is Cicindela puritana, the Puritan tiger beetle on the Maryland shore. Utter the word insect, and many people immediately think pain and destruction. This is usually followed by a desire to kill. So developing public support for insect conservation beyond butterflies involves overcoming what Michael Samways has called the perception challenge. Being small and quite obscure doesn't help either. In a 2000 Journal of Insect Conservation editorial, T.R. New asked how to conserve the weak inheritors, insects such as socids that, quote, do not bite or otherwise harm people, are small, obscure, and hard to identify, don't sell for large sums of money, and generally manifest features which continue to guarantee them political obscurity. While beauty and powerful imagery are an important part of pull, conservation for the vast majority of insect species will require gaining support for the small and politically obscure. That's why it's important to step back for a few minutes and to consider cultural connections.